Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Chileans in Concepcion plead for water and for police protection.
Ayuda, ayuda, eso necesitamos agua, ayuda. Que venga, venga la policía, seguridad, seguridad.
The earthquake in Chile was 8.8 magnitude. 700 people died. The Haitian earthquake was 7.0 and 230,000 were killed. Two countries, two earthquakes, significantly different results. Why?
Our building standards were strengthened over the past decades, and so you have a population that clearly was very well prepared.
A spokesman from the U.S. State Department, can we learn from Chile? Are we as prepared as they were? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, March 2nd, and The Takeaway is that some things you can prepare for and some things you can't.
Yes, indeed, and we're seeing that unfolding in the top story we're following this morning. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has arrived in Chile in the past 15 minutes to offer earthquake assistance to the people of Chile. She's brought 20 satellite phones with her, just a small part of a much larger U.S. aid package. The death toll from this weekend's earthquake stands at over 700, with the number likely to rise as communications improve in the hard-hit coastal areas. Earlier, we spoke with Jonathan Franklin, who's with the Washington Post in Santiago.
Sure, there was silence at first, but now what you hear is kind of the roar of a million voices saying, where's the help?
Where's the help? It's arriving today, with Argentina and Brazil both sending field hospitals and other supplies.
For the latest this morning, we're joined by Pascal Bonafoy, a correspondent for the Global Post in Santiago, Chile. Pascal, other people are saying that Chile was very well prepared for this earthquake. Do you think the people of Chile feel that they were fully prepared for it?
I think we all felt we were really prepared for it, but events proved it differently.
What do you mean?
Well, if in relation to earthquakes like in Haiti, of course, Chile was much more prepared. But there were major flaws also in the reaction. One was the Navy, which right after the earthquake said there was no risk of tsunami or tidal waves. And in fact, the whole coast was wiped out by tsunamis. And secondly, we're 3 days, this is the fourth day after the earthquake, and the food is just arriving this morning, and not everywhere. The water has been arriving partially. You see the Chilean government sent help to Haiti immediately, but it wasn't able to send help immediately to its own population in the south.
We're going to talk more about what was and was not able to do. Pascal Bonafoy, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
The U.S. Postal Service wants to stop mail deliveries on Saturday. The agency will submit a formal request by the end of the month to Congress to reduce its mail deliveries from 6 days a week to five. Postmaster General John Potter tells CBS News this morning the reason is simple.
Any paper-based communication is being challenged by how they exist and how they provide their service in an internet world.
The post office is $10 billion in debt. Canceling Saturday deliveries would save $3 billion a year. Meanwhile, President Obama is expected to explain his revised proposal for passing health care reform tomorrow. This comes as a survey by the Associated Press suggests House Democrats have enough votes to trigger a process called reconciliation to pass a health care bill with a simple majority.
Looking at the markets, Asian markets are mixed. European indices are up. Futures are up as well. The Dow will start at 10,403, the S&P at 1,115, and the NASDAQ at 2,273. Well, we're celebrating an anniversary today, the 45th anniversary of the release of Sound of Music, a movie that continues to endure.
45 is a number. Sometimes numbers mean more. In today's news, there's the 1,000th American soldier dead in enduring freedom. What do you think words mean? Are they clearer than numbers?
Good morning, Troy from North Dakota. I think our obsession with numbers in the Western world is unhealthy, and I think we're fooling ourselves to think that we can put everything in a box. Be more qualitative than quantitative in your own thoughts, and you'll enjoy life more.
We'll talk about the numbers. Reality by the numbers on The Takeaway. Reach us at 8778-MY-TAKE. Coming up, the latest from the Chilean quake in a few minutes.
We're following the aftermaths of the 8.8 earthquake that rocked Chile over the weekend, and we've been getting your personal reactions to the disaster.
This is Bill from Oklahoma City. I have worked with Chilean people, including engineers, and have been very impressed with them. Of all the countries in Latin America, Chile is probably the best equipped to handle a crisis like this. Very progressive country.
Obviously, if you have a personal take on the earthquake in Chile, you can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. But we're joined now again by Pascal Bonifoy, correspondent for the Global Post in Chile, who said that Chile in some ways was well prepared and in some ways was not. Pascal, can you give us details on how things stand in Chile right now? Has food and water begun to trickle in?
Was just beginning. The government just sent the first rations and they're being distributed as of today, actually. But we're now into the fourth day. Water has been distributed, but partially it's there's still a lot of need for water and food because people lost everything they had in their homes. Supermarkets have been completely depleted by looting, so really people had nothing to eat. So just now they're starting to receive food.
We heard a lot of reports of what they were calling looting. They instituted some curfews, and there was talk that they might have to institute martial law as well. Is there violence?
Well, there has been quite a bit in Concepcion and other cities down south. Last night, the curfew was extended. The first night it was between 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. Last night it was from 8 p.m. to noon, and people in Concepcion still can't leave their houses until noontime. And apparently, what I've been hearing reports this morning, it's been pretty calm. There's been intense attempts at looting, but it's really subsided in compared to the previous day.
Okay, and what does it look like when you look around? How bad is the devastation? If you see five houses in a row, are two of them gone? Have they mostly stood up?
It depends. I mean, in upper areas, hillsides, and some cities and towns were better. Are in better standing because they weren't wiped away by tidal waves. Cities, there's construction that's been destroyed, neighborhoods destroyed, but then there have been complete fishing hamlets and coves and small towns that have been completely obliterated by the tidal wave, partially the earthquake and then the tidal wave. And these people are in shelters or up in hills or at relatives' homes, and they've got nothing. They don't even have anywhere to go home to.
Hey, Pascal Bonifoy is a correspondent for the Global Post in Chile. She actually joined us from Santiago. And we're joined now by John Christian. He's an independent consultant, geotechnical and earthquake engineer. John, you've heard a lot of talk about how well-prepared Chile was and that they're used to earthquakes, and so they built to survive this kind of thing. In what ways is that true? How did they build for it?
Well, first place, Chile is a very modern society, and their engineers are very good. They're well known around the world. And what it has to do with the materials you build out of, the kind of structural details you make, how you design the buildings, how you analyze them. There's a whole discipline of designing buildings to behave well during earthquakes.
I knew this well because I grew up in California, and we even were taught in school about rolling buildings, constructing buildings.
That's a retrofit technique, basically. What happens when you have a building like the state capitol that you really don't want to tear down, but on the other hand, it's not really up to date, so you do something to separate it from its foundations.
To make it roll, it doesn't get destroyed. But, you know, we often think in the States that we have the latest in technology in these kind of things, and then we look at Chile and we have to ask ourselves, could we learn something from this other country?
Oh, absolutely. Look, as far as the technical capacity of the country, and particularly in earthquake engineering, I don't think the people in California who are our leaders in this field would think the Chileans ought to take a back seat to them. They recognize them as very, very world-class people. However, in any earthquake, particularly an earthquake of this size, you learn something. Something always goes wrong. And so always you have to go out and find out what went wrong and fix it. That has been one of the strengths of the earthquake engineering field, that they have a long-standing policy dating back, I think, to around 1930, the Long Beach earthquake, of actually going out and investigating what happened during an earthquake, writing reports on it, and then using that to amend the codes, the policies, procedures, and so forth. And I'm sure this will happen here in Chile.
You know, I myself am not all too badly concerned about California, because this is a place that's been dealing with earthquakes for a very long time. And I can say from personal experience that the people there are not generally going to panic unless it's a massive, massive earthquake. But are there other places in the United States that perhaps are not as well prepared for an earthquake?
Yes, there are. Personally, a comment about your situation in California. Everything you just said, you could have said about Chile 2 or 3 days ago. If there were a very large earthquake in some part of California, I think you would find in the first couple of days that there would be some things that would not work. I'm not blaming people in California. I'm simply saying that we live in an imperfect world. Now, as to the other places that have a problem, first, the people in the Pacific Northwest, the Oregon, Washington, Seattle area, have over the last maybe decade or two decades discovered that they are exposed to a much higher level of seismic hazard than they had thought they were. And this has had a big impact on their codes, and obviously means that a lot of their stuff is not built to more modern codes. More to the point, I think there are places like Memphis and St. Louis where not only is there historical reason to believe that there could be very large earthquakes, but in many cases, people are actively resistant to doing something about it.
They don't want to tear down the historic buildings?
No, I don't mean tear down the historic buildings. I mean actually improve building codes and things like that.
Well, because of the cost, perhaps?
Sure.
Okay. John Christian is an independent consultant, a geotechnical engineer, and an earthquake engineer. He joined us from Massachusetts. We also spoke with Pascal Bonifoy, a correspondent for the Global Post in Chile. She joined us from Santiago, Chile, and we will, of course, be bringing you updates from the aftermath of the earthquake in Chile as the morning progresses.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253. And now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in now on the headlines.
A Senate panel is going to get another piece of Toyota today, grilling top company officials about the worldwide recall of 8.5 million vehicles, the third such congressional hearing in 7 days. Meanwhile, General Motors says it's recalling more than 1 million cars to fix power steering motors that can fail. GM says the vehicles are safe to drive. The cars never lose steering, but may be harder to steer when traveling slowly.
The First Lady has made further comments about the health of America's children. At an annual meeting of the School Nutrition Association yesterday, she said child obesity is everyone's responsibility.
We have to be honest. Our kids didn't do this to themselves. You see, our kids don't decide what to serve or what is sold at lunch.
Those comments by the First Lady come as America learns the president himself may have trouble resisting a cheeseburger or cupcake. His doctor recommended that the president lower his cholesterol, which has spiked in the last few years. And finally, in order to hear this, you may now have to pass a special sort of breathalyzer. There's a device installed in the cars of first-time drunk driving offenders that will not allow the engine to start until the driver successfully breathes into the gadget. Cities in Maryland and Virginia are the latest to try them. They're following the lead of 12 other states who already use them. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up,
you're about to enter the exciting world of mobile animated display.
So that's exciting.
It is, actually, but mobile animated display, maybe the person looking at the display is the one who's mobile. New York Times finance reporter Louise Story tells us about the dangers posed by digital billboards.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first takeout is on business with Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, Louise.
Morning.
It turns out that distracted driving is actually a business story. Listen.
You're about to enter the exciting world of mobile animated display. We've taken the concept of billboard advertising and made it come alive with lights and sound and movement. Animated messages move across our mobile billboards in a way that demands attention and promises to change the world of advertising forever.
Great for advertisers, but perhaps not so much for drivers. The series in the New York Times called Driven to Distraction is all talking about the growth of this animated digital advertising on roads across America. What have you found?
So they are growing. Digital billboards, some people are calling them, you know, like internet on a stick. The companies that are the companies that are distributing these, even one of them, Lamar Advertising, that's a huge advertising company, they proudly said, you know, this is like a slide projector. And if you think about it, all day long when we walk around now, we see TV screens everywhere. We see them in the elevators we go. We see them in the shopping malls, the airplanes.
Bus shelters.
Yes, everywhere. But the problem is, alongside the highway, there are some real safety concerns. The Federal Highway Administration is looking at this. They're planning an eye-tracking study for the summer where they're actually going to install cameras in people's cars to see if their eyes stray extra long to look at these digital billboards.
How would they set the standard? I mean, the number there must be a little tough because, I mean, advertisements are supposed to distract you.
That's right. But, you know, since the 60s, if you remember, there were some big beautification efforts of the highway system in the 1960s.
Sure.
They capped the number of billboards at 450,000. And this has been this thing that reigned in advertising. Yes, for decades, you know, advertisers couldn't really up the ante on roadside advertising. And what these digital billboards allow advertisers to do is up the ante. There's about 2,000 of them now. Some people think it may become 10% of the signs on the highway eventually. And each sign can feature ads from, you know, 10 different advertisers. Cycle them through the day, show you coffee advertisements in the morning, beer advertisements in the night, you know, and so what they do is it really allows advertising to take the next level. The question is it safe?
They could read your license plate and figure out if you need to pay your credit card bill
billboard. Oh, that'd be pleasant, right?
You know, just before you go, Louise, you know, we've been talking about numbers all morning on the program. You do this as a matter of living. You look at numbers on balance sheets and economic statistics, and you have to make those numbers tell a story. How do you do that?
Well, you usually look for numbers to move in a direction. And what's actually been very difficult about this recession is so many different trending statistics haven't trended. You know, the housing numbers keep pointing different ways, bumping up and down, but you look for a trend. The other thing about numbers that kind of fascinates me is I think that in so many ways it's what separates society. I mean, more money you have, that's a number. More IQ you have, that's a number. We looked at percentiles, you know. So numbers actually often divide people. And, you know, when you improve society, it's often when you're moving the numbers around.
Well, numbers divide. Maybe coming together is not a matter of numbers. It's a matter of humanity.
Well, you know, we're going to go to the next person here who also deals with numbers all the time, and that's Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. And the numbers are definitely trending in favor of UConn. Not that there's any surprise that UConn is doing well at basketball, but the UConn women seem to be even more so than usual dominating college basketball for women.
It's true. Last night they beat Notre Dame 76-51 in South Bend to record their 69th win in a row, which means that they are one win away, which should happen this Sunday. They're one win away from tying a record that was set by the UConn women's team in 2001 and 2003 of having the most consecutive victories in women's college basketball.
So this school is about to break their own record.
They are about to. And on the tip of numbers, they're anchored by Tina Charles, who's their all-American, all-everything center. And she last night, not only did they win, but she also passed the leading Nakisha Sales as the storied program's leading scorer with 2,184 points. And she passed Rebecca Lobo as the leading rebounder with 1,273 rebounds. So this is not only is it they're getting consecutive wins, but they're also breaking records along the way.
Now, how are the men's basketball doing? Are they living up to the women?
Well, with UConn?
Yeah, with UConn.
Well, this year is not quite the best year for the UConn men's team, whereas a couple years ago they did a double. They had a dual championship. That's not going to happen this year. The UConn men aren't quite that good. No.
Okay, so who is doing well in men's basketball for college sports?
We touched on it yesterday. Syracuse is the best team in college basketball.
Well, and Kansas is number one, aren't they?
Kansas is not number one anymore. Syracuse has now been.
No,
oh, really?
Ranked.
Oh, they did.
They
oh,
are,
I thought they were going to
give
them the number
rank.
One, even though they lost.
They're in the number one spot.
Wow.
And we were talking, and so Syracuse is interesting because what they do well is what a lot of teams don't do well. they have a very balanced attack. So they have a very good inside game and an outside game, and they're extremely deep. So they can pull two or three guys from the bench. If you look at their minutes.
Oh, a deep bench.
Exactly.
Right.
So if you look at the minutes that they're playing, they're pretty balanced across the team. So they have about seven or eight guys that play around the same amount of minutes. And all of those seven or eight guys can put up double figures at any given moment. So you never know who's going to really come through on any given day for Syracuse. That's why I like them. They play great defense. They have the 2-3 zone. They're really hard to score on. And they're playing really as a solid unit. So right now, in terms of college basketball, men's college basketball, they're definitely not as dominant as the UConn women. I don't think any team in history will be as dominant as this UConn women's team. But in terms of men's college basketball, this Syracuse team is the most balanced, the most feared team in college basketball.
And they don't have to worry about injuries, right? Because
they have a deep bench.
They have a deep bench.
Exactly. Since there's a backstory here with Ibrahim and Syracuse. Is there something going on here? You got a relative who goes to Syracuse?
Well, okay.
Insider information, Hawk.
I'm gushing a little bit because I love the Syracuse Orange. And, it's just like when the Yankees won the World Series this past year. It's amazing as a sports commentator to be able to talk about the best team in the land and they're your favorite team.
All right.
Okay. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our takeaway sports contributor. And we are following the numbers, not just in sports and money, but all over the place. The 1,000th American soldier has been killed in Operation Enduring Freedom. That's the war in Afghanistan. And 700 killed in the Chilean quake.
That number's
we're talking
rising.
About, yeah, absolutely. And we're talking about the power of numbers. When have numbers meant a lot to you? Not just in news events, but at any time. Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to our website, thetakeaway.org.
How old are you? There's a number.
40.
Coming up, looking for a narrative in the numbers we see in the news all the time. That's coming up in just a few moments. But right now, there's plenty of numbers in the top news story we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Here's an eyewitness account from the coastal town of Pelhue in Chile of that tsunami that hit on Saturday. A resident says the tsunami came in three waves, surging 200 yards into town. He tells the AP he watched the wave drag away a bus full of tourists who'd hoped to make it to high ground. Rescue officials say only five bodies from the bus have been recovered from the more than 20 believed to be aboard. The death toll now stands at more than 700 from the Chilean earthquake. It's still expected to rise. In the city of Concepcion, the military curfew has been extended. We spoke to Pascal Bonifoy, a correspondent for Global Post in Santiago, who told us on top of the lack of basic necessities, the curfew is a growing problem as well.
The first night it was between 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. Last night it was from 8 p.m. to noon, and people in Concepcion still can't leave their houses until noontime.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is now on the ground in Santiago.
The U.S. Postal Service wants to stop delivering mail on Saturdays. The agency will submit a formal request by the end of the month to Congress. Postmaster General John Potter tells CBS News this morning the decision boils down to one thing.
The amount of mail that we deliver to every address per day is going down.
Post office is $10 billion in debt, and canceling Saturday deliveries would save $3 billion a year. Taking a look at the markets, they are now open. The Dow is up 18 points. The S&P is up 2 points, and the NASDAQ is up 6 points. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
Numbers, numbers, numbers. You know, there was a time when music was thought to be the dance of numbers. If Greek mathematician Pythagoras had written a symphony, it might have sounded like this modern Pythagoras symphony. Pythagoras, you see, thought that numbers were the tonal units of reality and that music and mathematics were the same. In our time, though, numbers and reality feel interchangeable quite a lot. 10% unemployment, 2% inflation, $1.7 trillion deficit, or the price of oil and pork bellies. That's the din at the pit at the New York Mercantile Exchange, where they trade oil futures, screaming numbers that determine all kinds of things in our reality, prices of fuel, cost of medicines, chemicals, foods. Perhaps Pythagoras would think of that noise in this way.
Cotton up 45, 80. Cotton up 45, 90.
Orange. That's a piece by audio artist Ben Rubin. It's his sound portrait of how trading numbers interact with music and reality in a more artistic way. Are numbers as useful as they are pretty? Well, let's find out, and let's have a bit of a debate. With us, with differing views of how numbers communicate to all of us, are James Geary, a journalist and the author of Geary's Guide to the World's Greatest Aphorists. James Geary, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, John. Glad to be here.
And Kaiser Fung is the author of Numbers Rule Your World. He's in the studio. Kaiser, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
So we have varying views here. Do numbers distort or give us a sense of the scale of reality? Are they a help or a hindrance? Do you prefer numbers, Kaiser Fung?
Well, as the title of my book implies, I certainly think numbers have a very powerful way of conveying information. And but it's not all numbers. It's picking the right numbers and providing the context for people to interpret the numbers.
James Geary, words are better?
Well, yes, as an author and a journalist, I would say words are better. I think numbers are important, and I think especially today when some of the biggest issues facing us involve numbers. You know, the financial crisis, global warming, all those kind of things involve science and numbers, and that's crucial. But I don't think science touches the experience of people when they're dealing with these issues. For example, I used to live in Amsterdam, and I lived right around the corner from the Anne Frank House. And when you talk to people about the Holocaust, you can name some horrific numbers, the number of people who were murdered, for example. But going to that house, reading her diaries, seeing the little secret passageway that led to the rooms where she and her family were hiding, no number can replace that. And it's only by really confronting the words and the words that speak to that experience that you really feel the impact of that whole event.
Well, James Geary, that's one for you. Kaiser Fung, how does a number of the scale of, say, 6 million, we're referring to the Holocaust there, or 1.6 trillion in the case of the deficit, get infused with a human story that causes the number to resonate in a more human way? We've talked about the earthquake this morning. We're talking about the 1,000 dead in Afghanistan, the Operation Enduring Freedom.
Right. So I think the a good example is if you think about the deficit, and we these days are talking about the trillions and trillions of dollars. In 2008, James Fallows at The Atlantic actually wrote an article called The $1.4 Trillion Question about, you know, how the Chinese government is funding our debt. Now, it turns out that the online readers really loved this article and spread it around, but actually with a very different title. It was called Average American Owes Average Chinese $4,000.
Well, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, and you could tell if you pick the right numbers, it makes a big difference.
James Geary, let me take it back to you. I heard a number over the weekend that was pretty interesting. If you take, and this is more geometry rather than specific algebraic numbers, if you take the Earth and make it the size of a basketball, okay?
Okay, I'm following you so far.
And you suck all the water off the earth, it'll fit into a ping pong ball, okay?
Uh-huh.
And if you take the fresh water that's available on the earth, it fits on the head of a pin by that scale. Does that use of numbers give you a sense of how much fresh water we have on earth?
Yeah, but you've also completely lost me as well. I think those kind of analogies are useful, but I think as the previous speaker just said, for me, personalization is the key. So when you name a sort of big generic number like the total national debt, well, that really doesn't. It's not immediately obvious how that affects me. But when you say I owe the average Chinese person $4,000, well, then I can understand what you're talking about, because then it's a personal story. It applies directly to my life. And I think especially with money, you know, not just the global financial crisis, but the personal financial crisis. If you say to somebody, if you don't save enough for retirement in 30 years, you're going to be really, really in a difficult situation. Well, that's one thing. But if you give them an example of someone who hasn't saved and who is in a really difficult situation, then the message gets home in a much more powerful way than if it was just a number.
It's the Aesop grasshopper and the ant story, right? Here's a response that we got. What's the importance of numbers? Are they more important than words? Here's one of our listeners.
Hi, this is Jim Barkley in Medford, Massachusetts. Numbers and words are equally important. As Norton Juster said in The Phantom Tollbooth, the kingdom of words and the kingdom of numbers had to learn to get along, because
you couldn't have tea for two without the tea.
Could you? But you wouldn't have
tea for two without the two.
Could you?
So, James Geary, we make it a tie here.
I could live with that.
Kaiser Fung, do you think people who use numbers a lot need to maybe use words to do what the title changer in James Fallow's article did, to humanize the issue of the deficit?
Absolutely. I think one of the reviewers of my book actually pointed this out, is that for a book that's called Numbers Real World, they are actually very few numbers, surprisingly, in the book. And that's because I needed to provide the context behind it.
All right, Kaiser Fung, author of Numbers Rule Your World, and James Geary, journalist, author of Geary's Guide to the World's Greatest Aphorists. Thanks to both of you. If you want to hear that musical composition based on the numbers from the stock market and the commodities exchange, we link it to our website, the Ben Rubin piece, takeaway.org. Coming up.
You are 16, going on 17, baby.
Two numbers right in order. Even in the Sound of Music, it's the, can you guess, the 45th anniversary of the movie. We talk with the grandson of Maria von Trapp, and the voice you're hearing right now, Daniel Truitt, who played Rolf, Liesel's boyfriend, the one bad guy in the Sound of Music.
Yeah, but they had to create a bad guy.
That's true. You'll find out later this hour.
Cats will offer you food and wine. Totally un-
Oh, man.
That sounds nice.
Great, but it's a little early for spring, sadly. If it were springtime, our listener responses theme might be, based on a conversation we had yesterday on the program, it's called Returning to the Nest.
My name is Emily Sussman. I'm 30 years old, and I'm living with my parents, too, on Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
And we talked yesterday about the trend of adult children, you see, moving back with their parents. The AARP reports that about one-third of all 18 to 49-year-olds live at home. And we heard a bunch of stories like Emily's.
I'm a journalism student. I'm still finishing my master's, trying to do it long distance. And I'm living with my parents. And it's even worse than the woman who was on the air, because Cape Cod is mostly a retirement community, but they're very nice.
This is Julie from Norman, Oklahoma. I have a slightly different situation with my family. Both my mother and my mother-in-law moved in with me over the last 2 months. So it's two grandmas, my three-year-old daughter, and my husband and I in a three-bedroom house with one bathroom. And when you add in the younger sister-in-law of mine, the talk becomes even more complicated in terms of the division of labor. 17-year-olds don't seem to be very interested in contributing to the household. Otherwise, it's been a great experience, and I recommend intergenerational living to everyone.
Talk about numbers. Three-year-old daughter, husband, and I in a three-bedroom house with one bathroom.
One bathroom. That's the number that shocks me.
Barb in Denver posts to our site, thetakeaway.org, this story. My parents made it clear that I could always return home if needed. I left home for college at 17 and returned for 2 months while looking for housing at age 27. It was such a gift. It allowed me to take some risks so I could follow my dreams.
But moving back in, not always that great. Laura also posted to the site, thetakeaway.org. My sister and her husband recently welcomed their unemployed adult child back into their home, and it's been a very difficult process for all of them. I don't see a single advantage beyond the obvious, a parent's feeling of responsibility to provide housing for a child in need, no matter what the age. My sister spent her life being a daughter, sister, mother, wife, with all the responsibilities. When her offspring flew from the nest and it was at last empty, she began to enjoy being somewhat independent, but in taking her adult child back into her home, she has once again assumed the mommy role.
Extended family, extended headache. But there is some advice we got for people like Laura's sister.
This is Alan in Somers. The secret to having a young person back in the house is not to make it a parent-child relationship, but to make it a landlord-tenant relationship. That allows the child not to feel infantilized, and it allows the parents to not feel that supportive.
You know how to reach us at thetakeaway.org or 877-8-MY-TAKE.
And let's move on to a different kind of nest last night.
Good to be home, Kev. I'm Jay Leno, your host, at least for a while. So actually, we were off for the last couple of weeks. Kind of like the Russians at the Olympics. Woo, what happened to them? Yeah.
Jay's first night back at the Tonight Show. I know John Hockenberry was watching closely. He did get a warm welcome back from our listeners. Or maybe you were holding out, though, for Conan.
Hey, this is Matt from Merle's Inlet, South Carolina, and I'm voting for Conan O'Brien.
Definitely Conan O'Brien. Clever, witty, wonderful. Jay Leno, average, common, trite.
Takeaway listeners are with Coco.
That's the demo we want, babe. I'm telling you. Go with Coco.
We wish him well.
Reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. And, you know, John, we're talking about numbers all morning long. How about this number, one?
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd lay.
Right, and then he met his goat herdess, right? And then it became two. And then, yeah, there's the mother-in-law that makes three. All right, you're going with me here.
I love it.
It's also the 45th anniversary of The Sound of Music. We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. But first, let's take a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. In coastal towns in Chile, a powerful aftershock has sent people running into the hills, fearing a repeat of the tsunamis triggered by the earthquake on Saturday. Meanwhile, Chileans have been telling the BBC what life is like following the quake. Here's Pablo in the capital, Santiago.
The old part of every town within Santiago City, they're all destroyed. They're all adobe-built houses. Adobe is a type of mud and straw. The roofs have come down, and so people either are sleeping on the street or wherever they can find family.
This morning, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton arrived in the capital, Santiago, to offer the beginning of U.S. aid.
Voters in Texas head to the polls today to vote in the primary election for governor, which will probably be decisive. The Republican contest is heated. It's, in a sense, a battle of the incumbents. Incumbent Governor Rick Perry, who's vulnerable, been trying to fend off a challenge by Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson. Joining us now is Ben Philpott. Once again, he's covering the race for KUT News and the Texas Tribune. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning.
So any indication of turnout this morning?
You know, based on early voting, it looked like the numbers in the Republican primary were up about 2 to 3 times what they were in 2006. But then, of course, Governor Perry was running unopposed, and so there wasn't as much interest and TV commercials generated.
So is the Tea Party credential of Governor Perry likely to bring people to the polls? We've seen the sort of Tea Party hardcore conservative independent voter much more motivated than some of the traditional party line people.
That's right, and Governor Perry's done an excellent job of harvesting those voters. You know, way back in April last year, he went to Tea Party rallies. He made, you know, brief mention to Texas secession from the United States. He gained a lot of support there. There is actually a so-called Tea Party candidate also in the Republican primary. Deborah Medina has polled as high as, you know, the low 20s in some polls. We'll see what she can end up doing today on Election Day. No telling whether or not the Tea Party people are actually high in number or just very loud.
And Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson is, by some estimates, favored in this race, right?
If the estimates were taken last year, that's correct. She has had about a 10% to 20% gap below the governor for about the last 4 or 5 months. Governor Perry has painted her as a Washington insider, and it's Texas versus Washington all the time as far as his campaign is concerned, and Senator Hutchinson has never been able to shift the topic.
All right, well, we'll talk to you tomorrow. We'll see how it turns out tomorrow. Ben Philpott, reporter covering the governor's race for KUT News and the Texas Tribune there in Texas. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
The sound of music.
It's been 45 years since Julie Andrews first spun in her dress and apron around the hills of Austria, singing.
Still see the grass.
Absolutely. Everybody remembers that. And people forget oftentimes what a huge success that movie was. It won 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. And adjusted for inflation, get this, The Sound of Music, adjusted for inflation, earned more than $1 billion
at
the box office.
Not a single avatar in the movie. Not one computer-generated effect.
Not one thing. Here to talk about the enduring appeal of this movie, The Sound of Music, two people whose lives were profoundly affected by it. Sam Von Trapp is a grandson of the real-life Maria Von Trapp, and he also runs the Trapp Family Lodge alongside his father and sister that's in Vermont. And we're also joined by Dan O'Truitt, who sang and danced as Liesel Von Trapp's Nazi turncoat boyfriend, Rolf. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Morning.
Sam, let's start with you. That was your grandmother that was portrayed by Julie Andrews in the film, and I have to ask you, how were the characterizations? Was that really what your grandmother was like and your grandfather as well?
Yeah, that was probably what she was like on a good day. You know, it's always interesting when one writes one's own story. The movie The Sound of Music and the stage play were based upon my grandmother's book called The Story of the Trapp Family Singers. So, of course, it tells her version of it. And she was a very strong person. So my Aunt Maria, who was the actual real reason that my grandmother Maria came to stay with the family, my Aunt Maria had been sick and was not able to walk to and from school every day. So my grandmother Maria actually came just to be her tutor. But she said that my grandmother was extremely fun. in the beginning. And later on, she became a pretty strong matriarch who really held the family together.
I've heard that the family calls her the tyrannical saint.
Well, that was actually a joke. That actually came from Theodore Bakel, who played my grandfather on Broadway, and he came to know my grandmother a little bit. But the issue that many of my aunts have is really with the portrayal of my grandfather, that he was actually much kinder than that in real life and much more gentle father.
Well, there's a couple changes, actually, in the movie, and I want to turn to you, Daniel Truett. You played Rolf in the movie, and, of course, in the film, Rolf turns the Von Trapps into the Nazis. In the original Broadway show, Rolf doesn't do that. I'm wondering how you felt about that change.
Well, the main reason I got the role was the first thing I had to do was the last scene in the picture, because part of the problem they'd had with the sound music, including certain directors, was that they thought it was a little saccharine sweet. So they had Ernest Lehman, the Academy Award-winning screenwriter, redo this, and they went to the character of Rolf because they wanted to bring in more the reality of the tragedy of what children went through and the indoctrination that would make them do such a thing as this, because they felt the film needed more of that realistic part. So, yes, they did redo it from the original play, and that's the first scene I had to shoot in the picture, actually, was the crypt scene to make sure that it was going to work and it was believable, and because I was the actual last person cast in the film, so it was very important for me in that character. So even though I was the turncoat bad guy, that's the reason I got the role, so I really can't complain, although I would prefer that people would think more of Rolf and Liesel in the gazebo.
Well, but we shouldn't gloss over this. This was Hollywood's first touch of the Holocaust, really, 45 years ago after World War II. It was a very sensitive, difficult subject.
Well, absolutely, and you know, I think that that's what the Sound of Music was trying to portray a little bit more, to give it more of the strength and not just be so, you know, just songs, which were wonderful, but at least it did at least give the reality of the tragedy of the Holocaust and the tragedy to both Americans, people fighting, as well as the German people, how they all suffered over this horrible movement of supremacy and indoctrination, which it was. But to take a musical like Richard Rodgers and Hammerstein did is truly incredible that it was that successful, and it's like no other. It's played on television 3 times a year and has endured. I still get the fan mail from all over the world, and no film has had the impact that this one has.
Well, Sam, I'm interested in wondering what kind of impact it's had on your life as the grandson of Maria von Trapp, and I'm wondering how present was this film and this story in your life as you were growing up?
You know, it's interesting. As a kid, I did watch it, and my parents tell me that I liked it very much. But then we really kept it at arm's length. And in our family, I think there was a real quest within all of my relatives to try to stay grounded and stay humble. And I think that they felt that if they were to really acknowledge and accept that this movie about our family was that popular, and if they were to actually accept that they were famous, I think they thought they might lose touch of some of those basic values.
So I
really didn't see it again until I was 23, actually. So people would ask me questions like, did the nuns really steal the spark plugs? And I would look at them and say, what are you talking about? So I finally got it all figured out when I was 23. I was living in Mexico and studying Spanish with a family down there, and I watched it in Spanish.
Was there any one thing in the film that bothered either your grandfather or grandmother where they said, well, that was not right?
No, I think the only issue was really just, you know, there were some small changes, but the structure is there. As I said, my aunts were a little bit disappointed that my grandfather seemed so stern. But what I think is most important is that the integrity and the principles come through, and the fact that my family were able to stand up to the Nazis, and not everyone was in a position to do that.
Sam von Trapp, grandson of the real-life Maria von Trapp, standing up to the Nazis there. He runs the Von Trapp Family Lodge up in Vermont, which is about as close to Austria as you can get here in the United States.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah.
We are, of course, celebrating the 45th anniversary of the movie Sound of Music. We also spoke with Daniel Truett. He played Rolf, Liesel's boyfriend, in The Sound of Music. And lots of people, it is an enduring movie, not just the movie itself, but the music.
It's been
covered. Continue this celebration by lots of people. We have a playlist, actually, of our favorite covers of music from The Sound of Music. Remixes, musical nods, everything from John Coltrane to Kenny G, LL Cool J, Gwen Stefani.
LL's the most rugged. God and no man's above it. Gotta love it.
Lonely goat herd? No.
Don't rain me.
Climb every mountain.
Don't rain me. Check it out at thetakeaway.org in the blog section.
We've been talking numbers all morning. What's in a number? Tom emails us, wow, numbers are important. Stop the presses. Maybe you can do a follow-up piece on why we need letters. You better act quickly, though, before you get scooped by Sesame Street. Thanks for your support, Tom. Take this number, 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'd like to hear your voice so we can find you on the street sometime. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.